Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. My name is Karen.
I'm Kristen.
And this is episode number 136. Today we're going to be talking about The Red Pyramid, chapters 27 and 28. And sorry if we seem like we're rushing through this or like we're impatient, because Kristen and I are playing some Lorcana after this. And I kind of just want to get to that. I'm not going to lie.
And for those who are not in the know, Lorcana is a trading card game. It's like Disney characters kind of like doing battle, kind of like a Magic the Gathering Pokemon kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But they're like Disney characters and it's really cool. And Karen introduced me to it last time we recorded. Yeah. And I may have bought two decks and started like building my own, you know, like building my own travel deck so that I can like come over and play and do all the things.
And if you're like, you're like 2 years too late on this. Yeah, I know. That should tell you how off the internet I am these days, because I had no idea this thing existed. And like I played Magic once with, like, a friend of mine and liked the concept of it, but, like, was never really going to get into it. And so I'm kind of had to start from scratch, which, like, you pretty much did, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was pretty easy to pick up, though, I think. And with it being Disney, I mean, that's just, it's so easy.
It just makes it more fun.
Yeah.
Because there's so many characters that you already love or know, and so, like, collecting the cards and, like, building a deck full of movies and characters that you love that are also, like, great cards or whatever. It's all part of the fun.
And so my boyfriend's cousin, like, we were talking about board games, video games, too, I think. And I was asking him, like, what do you like? And he was like, do you play Lorcana? And I was like, I have no idea what that is. And he was like, really? It's like Disney's trading card game. And I was like, what? Tell me more. And the more that I looked into it and the more that I saw that there are several Hercules character cards, I was like, gonna have to check this out. And I went to Walmart and I got the Gateway box, which literally teaches you step by step how to play it. And my boyfriend has played Magic before and was pretty familiar already with like how it worked. And this is a little bit different than that. But he was able to kind of like walk me through some of the stuff I didn't understand. And like after probably two games, I think like, I mean, I don't know if I beat him that first night, but like I've fairly consistently, we've traded off winning and stuff. And like, he's a very good, like logical, strategic person. So I was like, he's gonna kick my butt every time. And I've actually been holding my own a little bit. And then the mania set in and we have almost 700 cards now. Yeah.
Like, I think I have somewhere in the realm of probably 150.
Yeah.
And I just started this week, and I bought two decks, and now I'm playing with,
it's
like...
I mean, I've always loved collecting things.
Yes.
And so, like, this is like, ooh, they don't take up a ton of space. It is an expensive hobby, but I really like it. It's fun to play, and it's fun to look at the cards, and opening them is like...
Yes.
That same rush you get with, like, the mystery packs.
I was going to say, it's mystery packs, but also, like, on acid, because then you get to play with the cards. Like, so it's like, ooh, I have this, and this pairs with this, and I can,
And this one's shiny.
Right? Ooh, and I got a foil one, and I got, like an enchanted, maybe. No.
Yeah, I mean.
We all want the pretty ones.
So, I saw a statistic the other day, it was 1 in 92 packs, I think, you can pull an enchanted, like, that's the ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something like $500, $600 or something like that.
But I mean, they're about $6 a pack. 90 would be somewhere around.
I really want one.
Yeah.
I don't care. It makes me happy. I'll ask for stuff for my birthday and Christmas.
There you go.
Yeah. And the cool thing is, like, even though Kevin doesn't care about Disney, like, he likes these types of games.
Yeah.
So when, because Kristen and I don't live together anymore, and I only see you every other week.
Pretty much.
You know, at least in between, I can play with him, and I'm trying my hand at building my own deck. Which did not go great at first, but I think I'm starting to understand it a little bit more. So
yeah,
it's been a fun new thing to figure out. And as much as I love Percy Jackson and the Red Pyramid, I just can't stop thinking about Lorcana.
But we still are going to cover all the things. Of course. If we feel a little distracted there, it's because we are trying to go play our game.
Yes.
Sorry.
If you would like to tell us about Lorcana, if that interests you, or if you've played trading card games before, anything Disney-related, Percy Jackson-related, you know, whatever, you can contact us at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Instagram, or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. We do have a couple pieces of news today, not anything too big, but some exciting movement on the Percy Jackson and the Olympians on Disney Plus front. The quest continues, says the poster. And I literally just saw this morning, because again, not really on the internet.
Yeah.
So I went looking at Rick's Instagram and saw the poster. Great poster.
It's good. It's really,
really
good.
Dynamic. I believe this is Charybdis.
That was what I thought too.
Yeah. That's the whirlpool monster with the teeth and stuff like that. Yeah. I think that would make the most sense, but just a really, like, action-packed poster, and definitely, I feel like, continues the vibes of season one. Like, it very much is cohesive with that.
Yeah.
So, I'm really, really excited, and, yeah,
it's also awesome. It also evokes kind of the same feeling of that, like, the season one, like, we got the character posters, but, like, the Percy poster on the beach with the, like, it gives that same vibe.
Yeah.
Like, this poster gives similar vibes.
Yeah, it's, like, it's very cohesive. It doesn't feel like a completely different, like, thing, you know?
Yeah.
Even though, like, Walker's older now, it's season two, like, all that kind of stuff. And speaking of season two, Ariane did do, so Liam's been, you know, putting the work in over at Screen Rant with Percy Jackson's stuff, and he got to talk about, you know, what's been going on and stuff like that. And Ariane had a really cool quote that I pulled from one of these articles, and again, we'll link to everything in the show notes like usual, but the fact that Ariane is kind of alone for most of season two because he's separated from Percy and Annabeth.
Mm-hmm.
He's with the Cyclops in his wedding dress trying to survive for as long as he can.
Yeah.
So he really was essentially like filming by himself a lot of the time, or at least without like Percy, without Walker and Leah. And he says, I think the most development happened, oddly enough, when I was alone. Also, just personally, I was genuinely just alone in there. And I think he's talking about, like, you know, the cave.
The cave set,
probably, yeah. I'm assuming that was probably filmed in the volume stage. I feel like that would be a really good...
Probably. I would think that would be good. That.
Yeah. My filming schedule was different from everybody. He's forced to take care of himself, and he's in a situation that's so personal to him. It's like seeing Uncle Ferdinand in Medusa's cave, but just 10 times worse. And so he's forced to step up and take this leadership role that he's not really used to as a protector. It was an interesting new dynamic. I love that for Grover's character, the fact that he really is on his own, and, you know, he's out searching for Pan, and this is something that's very personal for him, and the fact that all of a sudden, like, he has to rely on himself to keep himself alive for as long as possible. It's going to be really interesting how they show that when he is by himself, and how through what I assume they'll still use is, like, the emotional connection between them, how that's going to affect, like, Percy and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to go from, you know, constantly looking out for whatever teen he's trying to usher from school or whatever, because Percy was not his only, you know, protectee, we know that. To go from all of that to you're on your own, you don't have anyone to protect, you need to be focused on surviving and getting through this. Like, it's definitely a journey for him, for sure. They probably shot his stuff anytime the others were out on set, you know, not in the volume stage, I'll bet you that's when Aryan did most of his work. So, like, he probably was pretty separate from everyone else. Not even just Leah and Walker, but, like, the whole cast.
Yeah, like, the rest of, like, Clarice.
Right, yeah, yeah. Like, he spends the majority of this book completely, mm-hmm. like, by himself. So, yeah, like, I'll bet that felt a little weird,
yeah, too. And considering he's acting opposite a Cyclops, like, they could have had that person there to, like, maybe read the lines from the side or, you know, something like that. But, like, he's essentially going to be acting against nothing or, like, a prop or yeah. something like that. So I'm sure that's a lot of, like, as an actor, personal development he went through as well. So I just find that really interesting. I'll be curious how they make it feel like these three are still so connected, even when they're physically apart. Because I didn't include this in our doc, but at one point, like, Leah talks about how in season three, like, she's going to be the one that's sort of separate.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be really interesting how they'll keep everything connected and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we'll see what happens with that.
What were you thinking, Rick?
You introduced
this trio, and then the second book, you send Grover off to nowhere, and then the third book, you send Annabeth off, yeah.
And in the fourth book, you throw Rachel Elizabeth Dare right. into the mix, and everything gets complicated.
What are you thinking?
And in book five, they kiss. But speaking of season three, we also now know that filming will start July 2025, and that's 2 months away. Less right. than 2 months away. So that's super exciting.
That also says really good things for season two, because if they're already starting production for 2025, or that means, like, you know, they'll be moving season two into post-production stuff. They'll be really firming up all of that. So that will definitely be ready by December, which we already know is mm-hmm. when that's coming out. And then I'm curious what this could mean for the release date for season three. Will they stick with their Christmas time release schedule? Yeah. Or because it's being shot before season two airs, could it possibly move to, like, next spring or something? You yeah. know what I mean? Like, maybe they'll move up the timeline a little bit. So I'm curious.
Otherwise,
we would get it the following December. So we'd get season two in December of 2025, yeah. and then we'd get season three in December of 2026. They could push it later, but I don't think they want to. You know, once the whole Disney machine gets behind you and they're behind it, I feel like they want to keep it moving. Yeah. It's like all the Star Wars shows now. All of a sudden, like, you're constantly hearing about new ones, and it's because they want to keep it in the zeitgeist. Like, they yeah. want to keep people talking about it. So I don't think they would delay it more than that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think season one to season two, we had a longer break because they were literally waiting to find out if they were going to get season two.
Right.
Now that we know they do, you know, and they renewed for season three, they can push that and get it moving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we can only hope. And hopefully we get, you know, plenty more. In a couple of months, we'll probably get even more news because of Comic-Con and all yes. that kind of stuff. So
very excited to see what they do with Comic-Con, especially since they'll already basically be shooting season three.
Yeah.
You know, they might have more to offer than they did the last time.
Yeah.
Hopefully
yeah.
have a trailer or some cool behind-the-scenes stuff. Yeah. Or, yeah, they'll hopefully have something really cool yeah. for
But maybe season two. Not any season three stuff. Which is okay, because we're still waiting on season two.
Well, if they do, like, a panel and have the kids will be able to talk about, well, we've started shooting season three, and we're doing some cool stuff. Like, yeah. there's always that extra little, like, well, we've actually kind of started, and I can't tell you, but, yeah, you know. Yeah. So, like, we may get little morsels for season three, but...
Right.
Yeah.
So, very exciting. I love getting any sort of news about the upcoming season, and hopefully we get some more, you know, even more book news and stuff throughout the next couple of months. We'll just have to see. But until then, we are jumping back into the Red Pyramid. We've got chapters 27 and 28 this week. And I feel like these were a little bit more action, a little bit more information, a little bit more of an even kind of mix of things.
Yeah, the second one is definitely... I would say there's a little more action in the second chapter this week. The first one has a little more of description and learning more, but it's all happening on the ship, and they're on the river, and so it has this, like, forward motion the whole time. Like, you can feel them kind of moving toward the goal, and so it keeps it moving a little more than some of the chapters we've had recently.
Yeah, and it didn't feel quite as overwhelming either this time around.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't like, oh, you definitely should have, like, split these chapters or something. It was a little more cohesive.
Right, yes. I can kind of see why you, like, the second chapter today is a little longer, chapter 28, but you can kind of see why it is the way it is.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it makes some sense. Okay, so chapter 27, entitled A Demon with Free Samples. So when we left off, Carter's Ba was, like, hopscotching all over the place. And now we are back in Sadie's POV.
Mm-hmm.
And Sadie is talking about how she basically slept like the dead while Carter was off doing all this stuff. And then, of course, Carter comes back and he's acting all, like, freaked out.
Yeah.
And I love that she, like, needled him about Zia. Like, did you see Zia?
Yeah.
And he just kind of gets this look and she's like, I knew it.
Yeah. I love Sadie's personality. I love being inside her head. It's just, like, Carter's great. And honestly, I probably relate to Carter more. Unfortunately, I don't know what that says about me. But Sadie's got this, like, spunky attitude that I really appreciate reading.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. So I thought this was hilarious. Khufu takes over the steering of the ship.
Yeah.
And our bloodstained dude, is guiding kind of his way. He's reading from the Book of the Dead, which he and Tut calls The Spells of Coming Forth by Day. And the whole thing with the name of this book cracked me up, by the way.
Yeah.
Where BSB, as I'm going to call him because it's just easier, he calls it The Spells of Coming Forth by Day and then explains that that's actually the Book of the Dead. And then Carter says, well, I call it Idiot's Guide to the Afterlife.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a good way to kind of like make it relatable. Like, if you think Book of the Dead and you're like, oh, that sounds really bad,
you
whatever.
Mustn't read from the book,
right? Like, you're getting mummy flashbacks.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, definitely. But really what it is like a guide to the afterlife and the land of the dead and like all of that. So I love that Carter brings it back down. Like, guys, it's not that big a deal. It's okay. We're all gonna be okay. They make it through the first cataract, but it's pretty rough. They're dodging like sharp fires, and there's like white water, which is actually red, so it's like red water, which and then like they do like a massive like spin to avoid a vortex and like all this stuff, so it is rough getting through the first cataract, but they make it, and once they pass that, they officially have entered the land of the dead. It's really weird. There's a lot of description in this chapter because you're constantly seeing the stuff they're seeing from the river change. So like as they left where they were before the first cataract into this first cataract now, like past it, you're seeing ghosts on the shore, you're seeing giant faces made of fog, you're seeing these hulking shadows that you can't really see a physical body for, so it's like, what is going on? Including like bones dragging themselves through the mud. That was really weird.
And yeah.
Then, like, connecting with random other bones. I was like,
yeah. Can you imagine this on screen? Like,
right?
That ended up being really like creepy.
Right? Like, yeah, definitely. Like, for sure.
Yeah.
And we also get an explanation. They are on the River of Night now. Like, before they were on the Mississippi River, and it led into the River of Night. And the River of Night is both every river and no river at the same time. So it kind of think of it like it every river flows into it and every river flows out of it. And how you kind of think that no river, you can't step in the same river twice.
Yeah.
Like, it's a Pocahontas, like, you know, water's always changing and always flowing. So, like, they're all connected.
Right.
And, of course, they're all connected to the Mott. So as they keep moving forward, the shore changes from just all the creepy things that I just described into like ancient creepy things. So you get ancient ghost villages and temples that crumble and then rebuild. And
sorry, you almost said goat villages, and now I'm just picturing goat villages.
Yeah. Just goats, just all the goats everywhere. So yeah, there's like ghosts reaching out to the boat as they go past, and Bast tells them that these spirits are the lost and confused. And we get this story about Ra and how he used to drive his boat, which was like the sun. It was basically on fire, and it came down this river, bringing light to all of these lost souls, which gave them a feel of being alive. It reminded them of the living world, and it brightened their day. And so then every day as he passed through, they got this chance to like feel alive again. And then he would pass through the lake of fire, which would reignite his boat and brighten it. Mm-hmm. And then he'd take off through the gate to the east and start all over again. So Ra has not been through here because he has retired. And so these poor souls are just kind of left. And they just seem to feel more and more lost. They never found their way to the Hall of Judgment. They're waiting for Ra to come back because that's all they ever really looked forward to. And it's just, that whole concept just, like, really got me. Like,
yeah.
Like, I don't know that much about Egyptian mythology. Like, I'm learning. And the idea of, like, Ra constantly bringing light through mm-hmm. to the land of the dead, like, to these lost souls is, like, really heartening, and it's like that's a really good thing to do. Like, it's, you know, if Apollo did something similar, it would yeah. be really cool, you know. But like,
well, Apollo did have his like chariot yeah. that he drove across the sky. Like, there's so, I'll talk about this later, but there's so many interesting connections to me between, you can see the influence and like the similarities between Greek and Egyptian mythology. But I really loved this like whole section too, because at one point Carter kind of questions, like, you know, the sun is the sun. The sun is in the sky. Like, the sun is not Ra, which does not drive a boat through the underworld. And he was like, what is going on here? And I believe it's, I don't know if it was Best or if it was BSB. I think it was BSB. Says, conflicting stories can be equally true. And that's so difficult for me to wrap my head around. But I also love that that kind of means, like, the world is complex, and sometimes you just kind of have to accept that. And it reminded me a lot of Magnus Chase, because Samira believed in, you know, she was Muslim, like, she believed in Allah, she believed in her God, and the Norse gods at the same time. And it even reminded me of the Lightning Thief, when they see, like, a priest in the underworld, and Percy's like, wait a second, like, how does that work? And they kind of explain it as, like, the priest probably doesn't see the underworld, like, he did a bad thing, so, like, he probably sees hell, like, his version of hell. And so it's all of them and none of them at the same time, kind of like the river. And like, that concept is just so interesting to me. And this is a middle grade book, you know. It's just, it's really like a really complex thing to wrap your head around.
I think it's one of the more important and ingenious ways that Rick has written all of his books.
Yeah.
Because if you lean into the Greek gods of it all and make them religious figures in your book, then that is going to limit many people who don't want to read that because they have religious beliefs of their own that they adhere to strictly and don't want to challenge those thoughts. Like, that's their belief system. And a book that is challenging them, saying, like, oh, these are the gods in this book. Like, sometimes you can overlook it and just be like, yeah. But some people find that really hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
By doing it like this and making, you know, making the Greek gods more characters than, like, deities. They are beings that may at some point cease to exist, but it's not, you know, it's like, they're different. They're bigger. It's not like a religious figure. They're a different kind of being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's such a smart way to go about it, because he acknowledges that religions exist in the world and that they can exist at the same time, just like science and Ra can exist, and you can believe in both.
Yeah.
You can believe that Ra drags his chariot through the underworld and then brings light to the day, but also acknowledge that there is a burning ball of gas in the atmosphere, yeah. and that is fire, and that yeah. is our sun. Like, you can have both existing, and they don't have to challenge each other. It's a crazy concept for a middle grade book to be tackling,
yeah.
but it also makes it easier for everyone to appreciate these mm-hmm. stories. So it's one of Rick's more ingenious points, plots. Yeah. I don't know. Like, it's one of the more interesting things that he does with his books.
Yeah.
It makes me happy. Every time we get into this section of those books, I just get excited to see how he's going to handle it here and with a different character. And, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we know that Ra has retreated to the heavens, and he's no longer traveling through the Duat and through this river either. And our buddy BSB recalls that the legend says, quote, "The world will end when Ra gets too tired to continue living in his weakened state. Apophis will swallow the sun, darkness will reign, chaos will overcome Maat, and the serpent will reign forever." Just felt important.
Yeah, it does. And also terrifying.
Right, considering all the stuff we've been going through with the legend and the things that are they believe are coming, and with their parents having kind of been involved in all of this, it's, yeah, interesting and worth noting, mm-hmm. for sure. Sadie, in her head at this point, kind of admits that this legend of, like, all this chaos taking reigning and taking over and all that, it just sounds almost absurd, but, like, at the same time, she's been watching magic take place, and she has a goddess in her, and, like, she, it while prior to understanding all of this, Sadie would have just believed they were all crazy.
Yeah.
But Sadie now has to acknowledge that, like, this could actually be a thing I should worry about.
Yeah.
And I like that we get that growth in this chapter, that mm-hmm. we see Sadie really, like, taking on some of that and saying, okay, all right, like, I'm gonna do my best to try and avoid that. Let's just put it that way. Okay, so then we move on, and Sadie she starts to feel a little guilty because she's housing Isis, and Isis had a role in causing Ra to retreat to the heavens. And we went through that whole secret name story from last time we have that, but I liked the acknowledgement that, like, it's not her fault, but, like, Sadie kind of feels a bit of it, that guilt, because she is hosting Isis. Yeah,
which is so interesting, because, as we know in the next chapter, she's very much like, I'm not Isis.
Yes.
I am a separate, different person. And so, like, these conflicting feelings, I think, just make her character more complex.
Agreed. Okay, so next, Khufu quickly gives BSB back the wheel, and BSB says that there's a challenge coming. So all of our little heroes and Khufu go down to the prow of the ship, and they're looking through the mist. They're not seeing anything. It's just, like, dark and misty in front of them, and they can't see anything. And BSB is still steering through all the obstacles that we experienced before. Bast says, "Mortal souls are always challenged. You must prove your worth to enter the land of the dead." She's talking about this quote-unquote challenge that is supposedly coming their way. That's when Sadie sees a reddish glow in the distance, and she kind of acknowledges that that's where they're going, like, we want to get there. But before they can, like, get closer to that, Bast starts commenting on how we really should have been challenged by this point, and it is at exactly that moment.
Shut up, Bast.
That the water boils, the boat shudders, and a giant figure bursts from the river. He's several meters taller than the boat, and they can only really see him from the waist up, so he's a huge being. He's humanoid with bare chest and a hairy bare chest and, like, purplish skin. He's wearing a rope belt with, like, leather pouches and demon heads and other stuff hanging from it. He's
bits and bobs and severed demon heads.
Right, as you do.
Yeah, all the normal stuff.
He's a strange combo of both lion and human. He's got gold eyes, a black mane of dreadlocks. He's got this blood-spattered feline-looking mouth, but, like, the rest of him looks human. That would be terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not gonna lie. Like, that, yeah. That just...
At first, I was, like, lion-headed, but, like, obviously it was a man, but I was thinking of, like, Sekhmet, because she's, like, the lion-headed goddess. Yes. And I was like, wait a second, what's going on? But I find it very interesting that, like BSB and stuff, he's, like, a demon. Like, demons exist. I think we have a very, very much, like, a preconceived notion of what a demon is and how it's connected to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But then they're also calling a lot of these, like, maybe instead of minor gods, they're just called, like, demons instead, which I thought was interesting.
Especially if they live and work around the land of the dead.
Yeah.
It gives that connotation of, like, demons are in hell. So
yeah.
Demons work in the underworld. So, like, I can see why these minor gods may kind of have taken on the word demon as their title of, like, what they are. So the creature scares Khufu, who does a flying leap into Carter's arms and knocks both of them to the deck, which I thought was hilarious. Bast knows she can't help with this. And I thought it was worth noting that Bast is not going to be helpful during this challenge, so there will be no asking the cat goddess to help with the lion man.
Yeah.
We quickly learn that his name is Shesmu. He asks if he is going to enjoy them as a treat, or if they're going to name his secret name, and he therefore would let them pass. And Carter basically runs off to go find the Book of the Dead, and Sadie is supposed to vamp and, like, keep this guy distracted.
Yeah.
Well, she does a pretty good job of that to start. She starts kind of flattering him, and, you know, you go with that.
She knows what works on men who look like him, usually.
And he's, you know, and Bast is, like, over there nodding, like, you're doing good work, you're doing good work.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the help that Bast kind of gives Sadie in this time. Like, she can't actively help, but sitting over on the side of the boat, she can give a little nod or a little nudge or, you know, whatever.
My question about this, though, is, like, why did Carter go run for the Book of the Dead? Because even if they figured out his secret name, they would need it from either his lips or the person who loves him most. Like, that's the whole thing with secret names. So, like, him finding the Book of the Dead never would have worked anyway.
That's a really interesting point, and I did not put that together.
I don't know if Carter just forgot, or if because he's a demon, it, like, works a little bit differently, but, like, in the end, Sadie does get it from his lips and repeats it.
I will bet you Carter wasn't thinking, and he thought, where can I get the info? I can get it from a book. I can get it from the Book of the Dead. I'm gonna go do that. And, like, I bet you it was more of just, like, a panic, like, I know where to find it. It's got to be in the Book of the Dead. I'm going to go look there. You're right, though. It wouldn't have been helpful unless they got it from there and then tricked this guy into saying it to them.
Yeah, which, I mean, could have been the tactic.
Maybe. But yeah, that you're right. Like, that is a little concerning, a little interesting. Okay, so Carter's taken off and Sadie's schmoozing with Shesmu.
I like that.
Schmoozing with Shesmu. I didn't even try. That just came out. But yeah, so Bast kind of pokes Sadie along and says, like, you know, ask him about his other things. Ask him, you know, the other things he enjoys and, like, all of that. Trying to keep him talking. And the other titles that Shesmu has earned throughout his time include Osiris's Royal Executioner, the Lord of Blood and Wine. We learn that Osiris lets him behead the wicked, then crush them in his wine press, and that becomes the wine for the dead.
This was very grotesque. This was very explicit and visual and grotesque.
Just tossing that detail on the fire, Rick. Like,
yeah.
What?
I think Sadie even goes, well, not drinking the wine for the dead now.
Right? Like, she says, like, memo to self.
Yeah.
Don't drink wine of the dead, because no thank you. But yeah, she begins to ask him about his other duties, which includes him being the Lord of Perfume.
Yeah.
Okay. Which, that's a random one.
I guess I kind of get it, because I would think, like, anointing the dead with, like, perfumes and stuff was, like, a common practice.
I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I recall a lot about that when we talked about Egypt in, like, grade school. I remember them talking a lot about perfume. So, like, it's not completely removed, but it seems random here.
Right.
And then he brings out a slimy pouch with a little clay pot of yellow powder that he calls Eternity. And it's not great, according to Sadie. She continues getting him to talk, and he talks about how he has no friends, so his secret name is safe. And he definitely tells Sadie his secret name as he's standing there. So she realizes it at the same time Bast does, that, like, oh my gosh, he just said his secret name, which I was intrigued. This is the first secret name we've learned.
Right.
We have not heard a secret name before. So I was curious what these were going to be.
Yeah.
Like, his name is Shesmu. Is his secret name, you know, like a last name or like a middle name? Or is it like a title or whatever? I was curious. we've kind of learned here that it is basically a title, but it's kind of like the Daenerys Stormborn.
Right.
Like her whole title, like Destroyer of Worlds, Breaker of Chains, like that's more of like what a secret name is in these stories, which I think is important to know and very interesting as far as like that's the thing you keep closest to your soul and no one knows and you have to say it and all of that. So Sadie interrupts Shesmu interrupts Carter as he's coming down. He thinks he found the answer and he's digging through the book. And she knows that she just got the correct answer straight from Shesmu's mouth. And so she says, Shesmu, slaughter of souls, fierce of face. And as she says that, he looks at her and says, like, how do they always know? Yeah. And I was so happy and proud of Sadie in this moment because she really did do it by herself. Like,
yeah.
Fast kind of plot prodded her along a little bit, but, like, Sadie was able to manage this situation almost entirely on her own.
And I think that's really good for Sadie's confidence because for her, like, Carter seems to know everything. He knows a lot about Egyptian mythology already. He's very traveled. He's been with his father a lot. I think she feels a little bit inferior to him intellectually, but like she's super resourceful and super clever. She proved that when they were at Graceland too,
yeah.
You know? So I think she's doing a really good job of leaning into what she's good at. Like you were saying, the vamping and, you know, that kind of stuff.
The flattery.
Yeah.
The schmoozing. Like
just
that's...
being super clever and resourceful. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So Shesmu is on his way out. He's kind of sinking into the water and she asks him for a free sample for Carter and he blows his little clay pot of yellow dust all over Carter and I just thought that was the perfect way.
Yeah.
To like give Carter a taste of what she just had to suffer through.
Yeah.
Like, I had to smell it, so do you.
Yeah, and you just gotta, you know, poke and prod your brother a little bit, annoy him when you can.
Absolutely. And so this chapter ends with them rounding another bend in the river, and they see that the river ahead is on fire, and they are rushing toward what looks to be a, like, a bubbling volcanic crater. And Bast says, the Lake of Fire... This is where it gets interesting.
Yeah.
It's just like, thanks, Bast!
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
And this is what I was saying, where, like, it's so hard not to draw comparisons with Greek mythology, because the River of Night that they were navigating down reminded me of the River of Styx, because that connects the mortal and the immortal world. And it also, when we were talking about, like, the souls and, like, all the lost souls reaching out for the boat and stuff, reminded me of Hades, traveling down the River Styx in the movie, and they're reaching up for the boat, and he's like, get off me, you know? And the Lake of Fire is like the River Phlegethon, which is also on fire. Like, there's a lot of similar concepts, even if they're not identical, that I've kept finding, like, interesting connections between.
And it's familiar territory for, I would say, most people who read any sort of fantasy that has an underworld.
Yeah.
You get this mix of, like, light and dark. You get the mix of, like, fire and then, like, desolate blankness. Like, there's always those kind of two extremes when you're talking about the afterlife. And so, yeah, you get a touch of that in here with the Egyptian Land of the Dead. And, yeah, it definitely correlates almost, you know, one for one to, like, a Greek interpretation of it, too. So it is. It's really cool to see. And, yeah, it feels different. Like, for me, reading this, it felt different than going down the River Styx and, you know, hopscotching to River Phlegethon and all of that. Like, it doesn't feel the same. So, you know, kudos to Rick.
Yeah.
Taking similar information and, like, making it feel distinctive.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to finish up with this chapter. So we've got favorite lines and favorite moments. Karen, what was your favorite line?
Mine was just the phrase, Khufu manned or babooned the wheel. That's just really funny.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
Yes, love it, love it. Mine is a little interaction between Sadie and Carter. Sadie's talking about the souls on the banks as they're driving down the river.
Floating down the river? I couldn't figure out what you would call that either. I guess floating, but, like, at one point I wrote, like, navigating. Because, like...
cruising?
Yeah. I kept wanting to say, like, riding. That wasn't right. Driving. I mean, you're driving the boat, technically.
Steering.
But, like, steering.
But that's, like, an action.
Yeah.
It's not, like, the movement, like, down the river.
Yeah, what is the movement down the river called?
Sailing? But it's not sailing if you don't have a sail.
Shipping? That's something else.
Yeah, I don't know. Steaming? The steamboat? Are they steaming in it? Because if you're... I'm thinking, like, if you're speeding ahead, if it's a speedboat.
Yeah, full steam ahead.
Maybe?
Yeah.
We're steaming ahead!
Yeah.
I don't know. So many title options for this episode. I know, so right? so mine is between Sadie and Carter. And Sadie's looking at these souls on the bank and says, why are they so sad? And Carter says, well, they're dead.
Yeah. And I just... And she was like, thanks, Carter.
Well, and he wasn't even being a smartass. No. Like, he was really just, like, a starting point, well, they're dead. Yeah. So, and it just got me. It's like, that's perfect sibling banter right there.
Yeah.
Okay, and then our favorite moments. What was yours?
I feel like ours are, like, different sides of the same coin, because it all has to do with the Shesmu scene. And mine was just Shesmu being an idiot and giving away his own secret name. How do they always know? Like, it was just so funny.
Like, clearly, he's not very good at his job. If his job is to, like, stop people, because he very easily gives
away
his name.
Maybe he puts all of his, like, skill points into, you know, wine pressing people's heads. Right. Like, he's really good at that.
And he's working on his roar, so he's got the ferociousness.
He's making so many Disney references this week without even really meaning to. It's,
they're just floating right in there.
God, it's been great. It's
Disney on the brain.
Yeah. Can we play Lorcana now? No, just kidding.
We'll just play it in podcast.
Like,
what does it matter? Okay, my favorite moment, yes, it's also kind of linked to that. I liked Bast helping Sadie just enough, but, like, letting Sadie kind of take the reins here. But I love that Bast was like, keep it going. Like, you're on the right track. Keep pushing him. And, yeah, it was just a cute little scene. I really liked seeing Sadie and Bast have kind of a moment. All right, so we are on to chapter 28, entitled I Have a Date with the God of Toilet Paper.
Classic Rick Riordan chapter title.
It feels so, when you get to use some toilet humor and mix it in with, you know, a little world-endy event.
Yeah.
It feels very Rick. Yeah. For sure. Okay, so the Lake of Fire is exactly what you would expect. It's a boiling lake. It's several miles wide, and it smells like burning petrol and rotten meat. It's what you would expect a lake of fire to smell like, I think. Yeah, basically. So they're cruising right along, and they get up to where the river meets the lake, and there is a metal gate blocking their path. And for a minute, it took me a while to understand exactly what this gate looked like. So if you picture Captain America taking his shield and shoving it down into, like, a stream, and it blocking the stream, that is what this looks like.
Yeah.
Only it's a bronze disc, it's like a shield, it's as wide as the boat, and it's half submerged in the river. It took me a second to really grasp what I was thinking, what I was supposed to be looking at. Okay, so on either side of the river, facing the disc, is a statue of a baboon, which felt important, and that is the only reason I mention it now. We knew that the baboon was the animal of Thoth.
Right.
Did we know that it was at all involved in, like, Anubis? I feel like we didn't.
I think baboons are just, like, I mean, I think they're Thoth's sacred animal, but I think, like, they're just revered creatures in general, so maybe that's why it's here.
Okay. Because, like, it felt interesting and significant that there were baboon statues when we know we just experienced the Thoth-baboon connection.
Yeah.
And I was, like, interesting that that's also here, because this is the land of Osiris, and we are about to meet Anubis. So, like, you know, it's kind of like, who is exactly attached to the baboon? But it might just be a sacred animal for all of Egypt, or, like, all of the gods, basically, which makes some sense. So, okay, we kind of talked about this before, but these are the gates of the west. It's on the west side of the lake. There's also a gate to the east, and this is the path that Ra would take across the lake. And I thought that was an interesting, like, visual to just kind of put the whole Ra pattern thing together. Sadie asks out loud, as they pull up to the gate, how do we get past? And a disembodied voice answers, but it's not a disembodied voice. It's a glowing bird spirit, aka a Ba.
Which I forgot they kind of look like turkeys when they turn into Ba.
Me too. It took me a minute because it's been so long since we read the description of what Carter looks like in his Ba.
Yeah.
And I forgot about it too, but we quickly learned that this isn't just any Ba, it's Iskandar.
Yeah.
And I was really, really glad that Sadie had a minute to talk with Iskandar after everything that happened.
Yeah, I did too. And, like, honestly, we hardly know Iskandar, and, like, his relationship with Sadie and Carter's parents is kind of complicated, but, like, he has such a reassuring presence, and he's so, like, wise, and I feel like he genuinely wants to do the right thing, even if he does sometimes make mistakes. And I was just really happy after having learned that he died that, like, we get to see him again like this.
Yeah. I agree. I definitely agree. So Iskandar is a gatekeeper for the Lake of Fire. That's why he's there. But he's really excited to see Sadie too. And they have a little chat about his motivations for what he's done in the past and what her parents kind of brought forward and how everything ended up rolling out the way it is. So we find out that Iskandar knew that they were both hosting gods the second time he met them. I would say that the first time he probably was suspicious,
yeah,
but didn't know for sure. He was solidly sure after the second time. Their mom convinced him that his previous order to make hosting a god a death sentence was wrong. And it took him a while. Like, he was hurt when Egypt fell, and he made it a death sentence to host a god because he wanted the House of Life to focus on something other than the gods are powerful. He wanted them to find their own power and to not just constantly be looking for a god to save the day. Right. And I think that his heart was in the right place. Like, he had gone through a terrible time. So that gave him some pause when her mom started talking about how there was a great imbalance coming and they were going to need the gods in order to restore the balance. And he was having trouble acknowledging that, like, maybe things need to change.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was a really poignant, beautiful moment for him to kind of say, like, if I had listened to your mom when she first told me this, if I had put my own pride aside and gone down this path, things may have been different, but because of my own shortcomings, this is where we are.
Mm-hmm. And Sadie very specifically says, like, wow, it's such a relief when an adult can admit that they're wrong. And, like, that is huge because, I mean, you know, as you guys know, I work from home, I work for myself, but, like, I have friends who are in a more corporate world or, like, you know, work with, like, other human beings. And the stuff that they tell me about, like, especially, unfortunately, like, boomer-aged employees and stuff, and how, like, they just cannot admit when they're wrong. And there's a really interesting generational divide there. But yeah, That's not about this. I wanted to talk about, this brought up some really interesting questions for me when Iskandar is explaining about how sad he was when Egypt fell to the Romans. And he specifically mentions that the blood of the pharaohs were too diluted to properly host gods, which was why he thought it was too dangerous for them to do that. And he specifically talks about Cleopatra and how, because she wasn't Egyptian, like,
right,
her bloodline was more diluted. And when she hosted a god, it did not go well.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sadie and Carter are powerful because their blood contains two powerful bloodlines, which have now been reunited.
Yes.
So was this an arranged marriage type of situation? Was it fate? Was it coincidence? Like, did their parents know what they were doing when they got married and had kids? Like, I'm so interested in the backstory to that.
Or was this the Mott?
Right,
finding
exactly
the balance.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't an arranged marriage, but bringing these families together was important for the balance of power for the future. So the Mott brought them together. And yeah, that's interesting.
I really love that concept because the idea that, like, if chaos is going to reign because Set's going to be released, you have to have that balance of, okay, then we got to bring back a more powerful bloodline to host the gods to keep the order. And, like, yeah, I was really hoping that it was more like a fate situation because I find that the idea of the universe balancing itself, like, really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Absolutely. Sadie has a moment and she, like, formally forgives Iskandar for the struggle that her mom went through, which ultimately led to her mom sacrificing herself to help loose the gods, like, to let them be free. So She formally, like, tells him, like, you know, I forgive you, which I think is a very important moment for Sadie.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. Because I feel like she holds on to things, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, she's a little bit bitter, a little bit cynical.
It's part of that ferocious, like, just part of her personality. Yeah. Like, in order to be the spunky, you know, kind of person you are, I feel like you don't necessarily give up. When someone wrongs you, it's hard to just let that kind of thing go. And how much more wronged can you be than your mother having to sacrifice herself in order, you know, you lose your mom because this guy didn't just believe her when she told him something. Yeah. Like, you know, it's definitely a poignant, important moment.
Yeah. And I found that, like, these two chapters, I know they're from Sadie's point of view, but it felt like so much happened to Sadie and within Sadie for these two chapters, because we learned that, like, Iskandar is the gatekeeper for the Lake of Fire, but he just died. Why is he the gatekeeper? Is it because he was the
head of the House of...
Yeah, whatever that guy was called. I forget, like, what the title was for that thing. But, like, is it because he was that? Or is it one of those things where, like, this was very personal to Sadie, so, like, he showed up because it was Sadie who came knocking on the door, but then why was she the one being judged? Because it wasn't Carter.
No.
And Sadie was the one who did the challenge, who figured it out. Right. She's the one who gets them through the gate. She's the one that meets Anubis. Like, why is this so focused on Sadie? Like, is this Sadie?
An Isis Sadie thing?
It could be.
Is it the Isis of it all? Because Horus isn't really an active participant in any of the Osiris Anubis, like, stories. So, like, is because Isis is being hosted by Sadie, is she the one, like...
Yeah.
Like, they're trying to prove that she is worthy.
Yeah.
You know?
Because I think, like, in the stories, Isis is kind of involved in, like, the middle of it and, like, the downfall. And Horus is kind of involved in, like, the fixing of things. So maybe this is just, like, Sadie's time to shine.
Right. Yeah. Like, that's... Because I think it's Bast who kind of says that once or twice. Like, this is your time. Or this will be your time. You will have a choice. And it will be yours. Sadie. Yeah. Like... Rather than, you know, one of you is going to have to do this. It's been very pointedly Sadie's decision.
Right.
Something's coming that she's going to have to make a choice.
Yeah.
Iskandar had some interesting advice for her as he lets her pass into the Lake of Fire. He says, not to let her feelings blind her to what is best when she makes the choice ahead. And he's distinctly referring to himself in that thought process. Mm-hmm. So it's not like a don't necessarily choose your loved one to save just because. He's saying, like, don't let your pride get in the way. If this is what's best for the world, do it. You know, like,
yeah.
I think it would have been really easy to make something like this, like, you may have to sacrifice something you love in order to do this. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying, like, you have to really look at the consequences of what is lying ahead, and you need to make the best choice regardless of how you feel about it, which is just hard and interesting.
Yeah.
So they pass into the Lake of Fire, and Sadie turns to talk to the others and finds out that while she was talking to Iskandar, they were all frozen in place, including Bast. Literally, when they all unfreeze in, you know, as they pass through the gate, Bast even, like, finishes her thought.
Yeah.
And she screams, like, bah.
Yeah.
And it's because, like, she was saying, like, that's a bah or something, you know. So I thought that was really interesting. Like, this was clearly meant for Sadie. And I think you might be right. Like, maybe the gatekeeper could be one of a million different bahs, but because it was Sadie... And Iskandar was the person she needed to talk to. That's who was the gatekeeper. Right.
Yeah.
Because I had a similar thought about the whole, like, why is he here?
Yeah.
Kind of situation.
And it specifically talks about, like, needing the courage to be able to do this and, like, you know, not to go all, I don't even know the word for it, philosophical, but, like, is there anything more courageous than forgiving somebody who's wronged you? Like, honestly, that is a very difficult thing to do, to kind of set aside your pride and, yeah, all that kind of stuff. And maybe, like, for Sadie, that was the biggest challenge. Whereas for Carter, I don't think he would have struggled as much to do something like that.
No, I don't think so either. He doesn't have that funky fire that Sadie has.
Like, yeah, I was gonna say, this isn't meant to be an insult, but, like, he's a little bit more of a pushover than she is. So I think for him, that, like, sacrificing isn't him giving up too much, you know?
He also is a little more intellectual about things, whereas I think Sadie is a little more emotional and lets her emotions drive her.
100%.
Whereas he could see the wisdom in forgiving, so he would forgive.
Right.
As
it's
opposed,
logical for him. It's an equation.
Carter has, he has emotions, but like he has a lot more intellect and is constantly running through what the right move is next. And so, yeah, I feel like this was definitely a Sadie moment because of that.
Yeah.
Okay, so they pass through the gate and they're onto the Lake of Fire, and Sadie sees an island in the middle of the lake that has this menacing, glittering black temple. And it is clearly the Hall of Judgment. And that is where we are going. Yay!
Woohoo!
So they dock at the island where the temple is, and our buddy Bloodstained Blade says goodbye, and the ship leaves.
Is nobody worried about how they're gonna get back? We talked about this a couple chapters ago. Like, be specific in what you need from him.
No one at all seems concerned about the boat leaving them on the island.
Yeah. I'd be like, where are you going, buddy?
How are we getting away from this? We're not dead. That would have been my question. Like, excuse me, sir, no one released you from service. You'll wait here till I'm ready. Like, I was a little concerned that he was just leaving with the boat. They did not release him from service because Bass kind of hints that they shouldn't. And so they let him go. And I don't know, I didn't look to see if you chose this as a quote.
I didn't choose it because it was in here, but I'm glad you put it in here because it was maybe the best line of both chapters.
So as Mr. Bloodstained Blade is sinking into the lava lake.
Yeah, as you do.
Carter says, stay sharp.
I imagine him saying it with finger guns.
Right? Like,
stay sharp.
Like, definitely. Absolutely. Such a good line. And Sadie shames him for it. Like, really? And it's delightful. I enjoyed it. Okay, so as they are standing on the island, a dog leaps out and tackles Bast. And it is called the dog in the book, like in the technical term. And it's capitalized. So I was like, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I thought the fact, like, I couldn't remember what happened here, and I thought it was going to be another, like, Greek mythology connection, because Cerberus guards the underworld, and so I was like, okay, is this kind of a Cerberus-like animal? And it turned out not to be that, but then it got me thinking, and I did the right thing, and I didn't do a deep dive into this because I did not have time, but I do find it very interesting that dogs are so often connected to death in the underworld, like hellhounds and all that kind of stuff. But I also feel like, you know, dogs guard things. They track things down, like lost souls and stuff like that. There's loyalty, there's fierceness. Like, it makes sense to me that dogs are connected to something that humans find so precious, the afterlife, you know, keeping your soul safe, where you're going to go after you're done living this life. It's just, you know, man's best friend. Like, it's very interesting to me.
It's also worth noting that dogs in this world can also are so connected to their humans that people use them as service animals, not just for things like seeing eye dog kind of thing, but like heart rate, and like you can have service animals for like a diabetes dog that can sense when your blood sugar, and it's like they can smell it. It's their, you know, enhanced sense of smell that allows them to note changes in your body, which is just incredible. But like there's also that connection with like dogs at hospice, where dogs will sense that someone is going to pass.
Oh God, I just got chills.
And they will go and spend time with someone, extra time with someone who is making their, you know, step over into whatever afterlife is awaiting us. And like, that's, it makes sense. Like,
ushering them into the afterlife in a
right?
way.
Like,
I kept thinking about Coco too, like the dog in Coco, and like, there's just so many connections. And I mean, if anybody knows more about this stuff, please write into us, because, again, I'm trying very hard not to do one of my rabbit hole research things, but I do find this very interesting.
It's definitely, like, a human-animal connection. It's not just, like, a thing that has been made up. Like, it exists in the world still. You can see it at work all the time. So, yeah, that is a really fascinating connection, too. Okay, so this dog is a jackal, and I'm not going to go into, like, the whole description, because we very quickly learned that this is Anubis.
Yes.
It's a jackal with a golden collar, and he quickly morphs into a young boy who is Anubis, wearing basically all black with a gold necklace. And this is the boy from Sadie's Dreams, which was a long time ago, but I still kind of remember him.
Yeah, vaguely. It's vaguely in there.
Worth noting, Sadie definitely has the hots for Anubis.
I think I have the hots for Anubis, and I know that's weird because he's meant to be, like, 16 years old, but, like, he is definitely my type.
The black jeans, black boots, black jacket, band t-shirt.
Yeah,
it fits your aesthetic.
I'm into it.
I mean, who doesn't?
Yeah, I mean.
We all love a bad boy.
Yeah.
So, when Anubis becomes human, Carter doesn't really waste any time, and he just flat out asks Anubis for the Feather of Truth. Like, listen, this is why we're here.
Yeah.
And Anubis looks at him and goes, but you're not dead.
Yeah.
Which is also pretty clearly true.
Yep.
Because Khufu is with them, and baboons, Anubis gives them a chance to explain why they, two living people, are here to talk to him. This is a very interesting little interaction. So Carter tells Anubis that Thoth sent them, and Khufu interrupts Carter very quickly with, like, two acts.
Yeah.
And Anubis knows everything he needs to know.
Yeah.
And it's just very disconcerting, because at first I thought Khufu was trying to stop Carter from saying Thoth.
Right, yeah.
Like they don't get along or what, you know. Like, yeah. I was afraid that Carter was putting his foot in his mouth. But no, Khufu just got it all across. Got the whole message across with a couple
of... Baboon is a very efficient language.
Apparently.
So.
Yeah. So, Anubis seems to understand everything he needs to know. He knows Carter is hosting Horus. He knows that Sadie is hosting a goddess. She's a little hesitant to say Isis because she knows Isis's role in the Osiris of it all, but she makes a point to say that she is not Isis, but that she is allowing the goddess to visit in her body.
Yeah, and I feel this was making me laugh so much because Sadie is not quiet. I mean, remember, she's like talking into a recorder with her brother standing right next to her being like, this dude is so hot, I can't stop thinking about him. And she's like, I'm not Isis, I'm not Isis. And I think, because it's very complicated, I think Isis is like Anubis's aunt.
Yeah.
And in Percy Jackson, the gods have no DNA, so, like, demigods hooking up and stuff is, like, it's not weird.
Yeah.
But this feels a little more complicated than that because, like, yes, she's not Isis, but, like, his aunt is living inside her body, and she's like, your nephew's hot, you know? Yeah, and it's just, like, it's a very weird situation at the moment.
Definitely. Definitely. Okay, so Anubis also is aware that they plan to challenge Set, and Carter asks if he will help, and Anubis kind of glowers at him, and then refuses to help and basically says, I will show you why, morphs back into the dog, and runs off. And I feel like Sadie and Carter take a moment, and they look at each other like, we're doing this?
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, so they take off and chase after Anubis. And they basically end up in the Hall of Judgment. There's a big room, and then there's, like, a circular chamber kind of at the center of the big temple room. Sadie is describing that there are two places present in the same space at once, and one of them is kind of more solid, and the other is kind of, like, transparently overlaying itself over the other. Right. So, the Great Hall is the solidly there present space. It's like, you know, has some blazing fire in the braziers and an empty throne, and in the center of the room there's a giant set of black iron scales that are shaped like a T with ropes holding up, you know, two golden dishes, each that's big enough to hold a person. We see that one of the dishes is bent into a V and the other is kind of dangling off one of the ropes, so clearly something's not going well for Anubis. Curled at the base of the scales is this creature that we find out is Ammit the Devourer. Quickly, the description, head of a crocodile with a lion's mane. The front half of the body is a lion, the back end is a hippo, and then it's the size of an average poodle. I love that Sadie calls it a hippo doodle.
I want a hippo doodle. That's all I'm saying. Are you kidding me?
I mean,
Please.
It sounds delightful.
Yes.
I'm a hippo fan. They're my favorite. So I'm not saying no.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the crocodile mouth might be, might have to negotiate. But other than that, I mean, it sounds cute. Okay, so that is like the solidified layer of the room. The other layer that she's seeing is a ghostly graveyard. If you're trying to envision it yourself, the easiest way I can say, because we learn pretty quickly what graveyard she's seeing, think of the old New Orleans raised, what do they call them? Like the old New Orleans crypts that are above the ground level because they can't bury bodies in New Orleans.
Like a mausoleum?
Yes.
Yeah.
If you've ever watched any crime show set in New Orleans, they've gone to one of these and you know what it looks like. So if you can kind of envision that like floating over top of everything and kind of superimposing itself, that's what Sadie is experiencing in this room right now. Khufu runs in the room and heads straight for the scales, climbs to the top, and just makes himself at home. Is he, like, just laying on the T-bar at the top of the scale? Like,
I think he was, like, trying to, like, balance on it or something.
Okay.
Like, he's just jumping all over the
place. Like, he's just making himself comfortable, which is fascinating and hilarious. Anubis turns himself back into his boy form so he can talk to them and says, "Welcome to the last room you will ever see," which is just a great way to start.
Thanks. So cryptic. So ominous.
Love it so much. The scales are clearly broken, and he describes Mott is weakening. He tried to fix them, but has had no success. And we quickly learn that Sadie can see the graveyard, but Carter cannot. And Anubis is interested in what Sadie sees and hears, standing in this room with this graveyard kind of trying to superimpose itself. And she tells him that she can hear jazz music. And she closes her eyes to kind of listen deeply. And when she reopens them, the hall itself has faded away, complete with Carter, Emmett, and Khufu. She can't see them or hear them anymore. And they are now in the graveyard where she notices, like, the headstones are all in French. And it's pretty clearly New Orleans with mm-hmm. the jazz funeral going on in the background.
Yeah. And just, again, very interesting that this is Sadie, that she's the one that can see it. And I kind of feel like Carter is going to be a little bit miffed because, again, hate that I relate to him the most, but Carter's a bit of an overachiever. And the fact that he's not keeping up with Sadie in these last few, like, challenges and moments, I think is going to bug him a little bit.
I definitely agree. He's going to be annoyed that she has been so, not just because he wants to be involved, but, like, she's been the only one doing anything the last couple of days of this trip, it feels like. And I know he wants to help. He wants to be there.
Yeah, and he's, you know, the book guy. Let me read the book and figure out the answer. And she's just like, I'll wing it. And it works. Like, it's natural talent. And for somebody who is, you know, very studious and, like, a book nerd and stuff, like, that is a very difficult thing to get past because you don't always have that talent, you know?
I would say, personally, I think I'm a little 50-50. I was not a studier in grade school. Like, when there were tests, I just showed up and took them and did all right for myself because I paid attention in class. But, like, I think I have a bit of both of them. Like, I love a good book. I love to learn. I love to research. But, like, at the same time, sometimes I'm like, let's just see what happens.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I would rather do that than spend my time trying to learn every bit of this. Anyway, if you're not familiar with the jazz funeral in New Orleans, people dress in black, but, like, everything else is brightly colored, and there's a lot of, like, joyous music. They are all about the trumpets and the trombones. Like, it's very brassy and bold and loud.
It's very much like a celebration.
Yes. It's very much a celebration. And we learn from Anubis that the idea of the jazz funeral, particularly the part where they bury the loved one in the grave, like in the crypt, and as they're leaving there, they're playing this music to separate the grief of losing this individual from the celebration of their life. Like, leaving that behind, and he calls that very Egyptian, which mm-hmm. I just thought was, it just felt important, and also, like, it's a bonding moment here. Like, experiencing this with Sadie and kind of describing why this is so Egyptian just felt really interesting. So Anubis brought her to the graveyard so they could have a talk. He makes a bench out of a strip of white mummy cloth that he pulls from a crypt, which is just so cool.
Which is where we get the dot of toilet paper from, which was pretty funny.
Definitely a reference. Anubis is not a big fan of Horus, which is why he's latched on to Sadie here and not Carter. Makes sense. He's always liked Isis. And again, Sadie makes it clear that she is not Isis, that she is just hosting Isis. But Anubis takes a moment. He points out that Sadie has a glow about her that reminded him of her mother. But he's put his foot in his mouth because as a guardian of the underworld, he is not supposed to talk about dead people's journey after death.
Right.
Each of their journeys is individual and he's not supposed to talk about it. And he kind of made a mistake by mentioning her mom and having talked to her mom after her death. And Sadie wants to know more, and he can't give her more. So it's kind of a contentious moment, because she can't even... She just wants to know if her mom passed through the Howl of Judgment. Did she, you know, make it to the afterlife? What is going on? And he can't give her anything. So eventually Sadie gives up all of that and just asks him again for the Feather of Truth. And he tells her that giving it to a mortal would go against the rules of Osiris. And he said he was really puzzled that when the five were released, when Julius sacrificed himself and the five were released, Osiris did not return. And that's because we know Osiris is trapped in Julius's body, but Anubis did not know that. So Sadie is able to let him know, like, that's why. And he kind of trips over his words a little bit, and we hear him almost refer to Set as his father.
Yeah.
Which we know. But he's, like, reticent to say it, and then has to kind of go on to explain later. Sadie kind of calls him out on it in a minute. Yeah.
Anyway, again, can we make this any more awkward? Crushing on a dude, and she's trying to defeat his father. Right. Like, this is not gonna go well for Sadie.
Yeah. So I thought this bit with the Feather of Truth was really interesting.
Yeah.
Because Anubis doesn't want to give it to her. Not just because he doesn't want to, which is what the Greek god would have done, by the way. It would have been, I just don't want to give it to you.
Yeah. Also, go do this quest for me first.
You have to do this favor for me. Yeah. No. Anubis doesn't want to give it to her because a single untruth spoken while carrying the feather, not even, like, holding it in your hand, but if, like, you're the person in charge of it, if you speak one untruth, it will burn you to ash.
Yeah.
And that is terrifying.
Especially because out of the two of them, Sadie's the one who's gonna fib a little bit, you know?
Oh, yeah. Especially if the situation calls for it. So it is a little bit alarming that Sadie's...
I feel like this could get her into some really funny situations.
Oh, definitely. Like, for sure. This is where she kind of calls him out on not referring to Set as his father, but she makes it clear that she knows how Set is related to Anubis and, like, how that all shakes out. And then there's a whole bit about her not being married, and she kind of scolds him for him being incredulous about it, which I just thought was hilarious.
Because she's, like, 12, but almost 13, but a very mature almost 13.
And, like, he's from a very different time where, I don't know. I don't know how old you are, but you look like marrying age. Whatever. Anubis then goes on to tell her about his father, Set. He's never met Set. Nephthys gave Anubis to Osiris because Anubis wasn't a warrior, so she gave him away to Osiris because it just didn't fit what she thought a son should be, necessarily. Just one of those asides that you know is going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that whole interesting dynamic between you and your mother is definitely gonna... Yeah.
Yeah.
It's gonna come back.
No wonder Anubis is such a sad boy.
Right. Yeah. Fun fact, years do not... don't pass in the land of the dead, which Anubis is kind of describing to Sadie why he doesn't feel like he fits in, like why things feel so weird. And it's because he is still young, but he's been around for 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. And it just, he feels out of place because he knows both what it feels like to be old, but also be himself because he's been stuck in the land of the dead for so long. So Sadie basically bites the bullet and she asks Anubis to help them. She talks about sending Set back to the Duat, saving her dad, and freeing Osiris. Since the scales have been broken, Anubis talks about how souls are getting confused and they can't find their way to the afterlife. And, like, the Hall of Maat is, like, the center of order. And things are clearly, like, if that is being affected by this, then everything is.
Right. And this, again, reminded me so much of Hades, of the underworld. There's, you know, order down there. There's rules. Like, Hades is the one that kind of changed the whole idea of the underworld to make it more orderly. He's one of the few gods who does his best to help humanity, even though he's associated with death and was, like, feared and respected and especially now, like, sometimes misunderstood. And I feel like Anubis is the same way, where, like, he has this job and he takes it very seriously. And this is the one thing that gets him to hand over the feathers when she's like, but if you don't, the souls aren't going to be able to make it to the underworld. Everything's going to be chaos. And he's like, you're right. We need to fix this. And I just really like the comparisons there.
Definitely. Absolutely. So Anubis hands over the feather, but he has conditions. One, only Sadie may handle the feather, which makes sense. Although I do feel like Carter may be better accustomed to it. He doesn't seem like a fibber. You know right. what I mean? Like, Carter could definitely handle this, so I'm intrigued as to why Anubis thinks Sadie herself should be the only one handling.
It's probably just because of Horus.
Well, yeah, I do agree. Yes. Yeah. Two, she must listen to Nephthys. He talks about how he knows they're looking for Nephthys, and if they meet her, she must listen to her, mm-hmm. which is intriguing as yeah. well. And then three, he needs her to answer three questions while holding the Feather of Truth to prove herself honest.
It's always threes.
Yeah. Okay. We learn that the feather itself is the tail feather from a Bennu, which is a phoenix, and it weighs exactly the same as a human soul, which makes sense with the whole scales of justice right. thing. Yeah. We get into the first question. He asks her, are you ready? To which Sadie replies, no. And then she says, is that the first question?
Yeah.
And he goes, okay, yeah, that was really smart. Yeah, that is your first question. Okay, moving on. Question two. Would you give your life for your brother? And Sadie has no problem answering yes immediately. And he can sense that there is no doubt in her mind that yes, she would do
yeah.
that.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a little surprising to her too, but like she knows that it's the truth.
Yeah. Which it feels right for Sadie's character yeah. too. Like it just feels like yes, she would absolutely do that.
Yeah.
And the final question, if it means saving the world, are you prepared to lose your father? Sadie gives it a minute. And kind of says that it's an unfair question and, you know, talks about how that, you know, it just doesn't seem kosher.
She really doesn't want to answer right. it.
But she does. And she says, if there is really no other way to save her dad and the world at the same time, she would choose the world. And as she says that, she immediately feels like garbage.
Yeah.
She's like, who, you know, what kind of daughter am I? You know, I would sacrifice my father for the world, like, and then she kind of gives herself an out and is like, even as a girl who has only seen my dad once a year, you know, twice a year for this, it still feels like a betrayal. Like, mm-hmm. she still feels terrible for saying it. But your father versus the world, I think Julius would understand. I mean, it's what he did. He sacrificed himself yeah. in order to possibly save the world. So I think he would understand.
Yeah. But I also found this so interesting considering what Thoth accused her of, that she'd sacrificed the world to save her family. Like, that's sort of the whole connection between her and Isis, is that Isis kind of did a bad thing to, like, save her family, and Sadie understood where she was coming from, and the fact that this is still her truth, I think, means that Sadie's come a long way already, and that she's really doing some, like, soul-searching, and she really understands that, like, yes, I feel terrible about this, but when you weigh the two, like, I mean, you can't sacrifice one person for the whole world. I mean, she'd probably feel even worse.
Yeah, for sure. Anubis believes her, and the feather doesn't burn her to a crisp, so I'm sure that made it really easy
Yay.
To believe her.
Yeah, yep. right? And she points that out, too.
After that, Anubis disappears, and suddenly Carter and Khufu are next to her, and they're still in the graveyard. They're not in the hall anymore. And Carter kind of starts to ask questions about what just happened. And rather than answer them, because now she has the feather of truth and cannot lie, or, you know, she has to answer him truthfully, instead of answering him, she just kind of bats him away and says, let's get going. We need to get moving.
Yeah.
And that is the end of this chapter. It was a lot. was a lot in that chapter. We still have favorite lines and favorite moments to go through. So, Karen, what was your favorite line?
Mine was when Anubis said, "Or perhaps you could bring me up to speed on modern courtship rituals." I got, like, a little giggly during that part. Like, my heart leaped a little bit, and I was like, oh, he's flirting with her.
We do have flirtation going on. Yes, no. And I'm definitely into the Sadie Anubis thing. Yeah. I think they're adorable, so that's cute. Mine was between Anubis and Sadie, and it was in that last little section. Anubis says, "I believe you, Sadie," and Sadie says, "Oh, really? I'm holding the bloody feather of truth, and you believe me? Well, thanks."
Yeah.
Just
classic Sadie answer.
Very Sadie. And then favorite moments. What was yours?
The hippo doodle. There was actually like a lot of really wonderful moments in this chapter, especially surrounding Sadie and like how far she's come. But I really kind of latched onto the hippo doodle. And when Anubis says, and I can imagine him delivering this so earnestly and like genuinely, and he goes, "Amit the Devourer, look upon him and tremble."
And it's a little poodle-shaped, yeah, like poodle-sized thing. Yeah, yeah, definitely. I personally was a fan of Sadie not being able to get past her physical attraction to Anubis, even at the end when she's completely irritated with him. Yes. She's still like, "But he hot."
Yeah.
And I just, I'm thoroughly, definitely here for Sadie Anubis.
It's giving coupling. A little bit enemies to lovers, a little bit rivals to lovers. I'm into it.
A little bit forbidden relationship.
Yes.
A little bit of that.
Love that.
All the romance tropes. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Instagram at Prophecy Radio Podcast or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us and our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and we really appreciate them. You can leave us questions, comments, ideas for content you want to hear from us in either of these places. We don't really have any feedback this week, but we will definitely keep our eyes peeled for any messages from you guys this week. And we always look forward to hearing from you. So feel free to let us know if you have questions about Lorcana or anything else that we ever touch on, really. We love hearing from you guys. Next time, which we're not entirely certain exactly when this will be, because I am going out of town on a vacation. I'm very excited. I'm going to Maine, as I've talked about before. And so we're not entirely sure when the next episode will come out. But we will be talking about the Red Pyramid chapters 29 and 30, probably somewhere around June 11th.
Yeah,
so
2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just somewhere. A little break in there because of some complicated scheduling.
Yeah.
Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.